Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. Before we jump into this conversation, I will remind you the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urban Magazine, Urbanite Magazine's new e-zines. It's a simple way to stay connected to the topics and events you care about most. Daily content on arts, culture, food, design, style, green living, and much more can be delivered to your inbox. Registration is available at urbaniteBaltimore.com. And Urban Magazine is available in thousands of stores all around the metro area and is a very hip and important magazine for us to brings us issues to wrestle with and great arts to look at. And speaking of somebody who does that on his own right is a man who first came on this show. Actually, I was just looking it up. On June 15th, 1993, Luis Rodriguez was here to talk about his book, Always Running, La Vida Loca, Gang Days in L.A. And Luis Rodriguez is a one of our great revolutionary leaders. He is an artist. He founded a cultural center in L.A. Now he's working in Teatro Central Cultural. He is latest book, which we'll look forward to talking to him about as well when we get a chance to read it, is It Calls You Back, An Odyssey Through Love, Addiction, Revolutions, and Healing. And he was going to join us on this show a couple of weeks back, but we got our signals crossed. We were looking at his piece he wrote for Huffington Post, Why We Need a Deeper Dialogue on Black-Brown Relations, which blew my mind as I read it. He just wrote another piece the other day on the Huffington Post that I just read called Latino Heritage Month, Who We Are and Why We Celebrate. And usually, as you know, I hate ghettoized months because Latino and Black History Month and all those things are, to me, 24/7, 365. But they are important in their own right as well. And so now let me welcome Luis Rodriguez to the program. Luis, welcome. Good to have you back after all these years.
Mark, I really appreciate you having me back. That's amazing.
410-319-8888 is the number here. You can write to us here at steinershow at gmail.com. 410-319-8888. Luis, God, there's so many places to start this conversation with you. It's been so long. But let me just begin by, you know, when people heard I was doing the show, somebody said, oh, you're going to do a show with Luis Rodriguez because it's, Latino, what's the name of this month we're supposed to have? Latino Heritage Month. And I said, well, no, I wasn't going. He's not here for that reason, but that's, I'm glad he's here during that month, but it's not for that reason. But you wrote a piece in the Huffington Post about that.
Yeah. And
while that month can be a contradiction, it also has some importance.
Well, I think people get confused, you know, because I always feel like being Latino doesn't necessarily mean we all look the same, act the same, and we all have the same interests. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's not a cohesive group of people as even African Americans, which is much more cohesive. But but there's a lot to celebrate there. There's so much diversity, variety, culture, music, racial, because we come from all races. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
There's an amazing culture that Latinos can make claim to and celebrate and also give to this country. So I wanted to give that emphasis, but I didn't want people to think that now we're one ethnic group and we're all one happy family. It's
true. Well, I was thinking about that coming in. I was talking to one of the administrators here, Asita, who is from Guyana.
Oh, yeah.
And so, you know, she's from Guyana. That's in South America. Her hair is pretty.
Nobody thinks of her as a Latina, probably. They don't probably make the connection.
Exactly.
Yeah. No, I think that's why it's kind of confusing to me. And that, you know, being from Mexico, even Mexico is regional. Depends on what part of the region, you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, yeah.
And I want people to know that we have a great diversity, and there's people who are, Black Latinos, and there's Native Latinos, and there's mixture Latinos, white Latinos, and Chinese Latinos. You know what I mean? We're a culture that's rich, but at the same time, there's also interests, like class interests. You know, when there's poor Latinos, there's a lot of them in this country, and then there's people with money who could care, you know, who could care less. And I'd like to make those distinctions so people don't put us all in the same boat, you know.
I'm curious just analytically why you think that happens in America. Why do, you know, when people always talk about the Latino voice, the Latino vote, the Latino culture, when we're talking about Cubans, Puerto Ricans, Mexicans, Dominicans, you know, I mean, but we lump them. It's a lump.
It's a big lump. And I think partly because it's hard for us to fathom how complicated the world really is.
You know,
They want to categorize everything in such neat little packages. So that gets much my challenge. You know, you can't really neatly put me in a package. Obviously, if you're from Colombia, you don't want to be called Mexican because that's not who you are. And then when you're in this country, And maybe you think, well, I'm an American, you know, but yeah, you're an American and you have great heritage. You know, you don't have to forget who you are. You don't have to forget where you came from. But you also have something to contribute in this country that's unique. You know what I'm trying to get at. So I think I like to bring in the complexity so people don't get into those categorical boxes and get hidden away in there.
Now, the piece that I that really struck me when I first called you on about the show was the piece you wrote about Cat Williams when he, the comic, who's African American, who went off at his show at one a heckler in the audience. Somebody made a comment from the audience and went into this kind of anti-Latino rant.
Yeah, I thought it was really bad on his part. But I didn't want to join in. There were so many people on Facebook and on the internet that was really ramming it down his throat. I thought, well, listen, let me use this as a moment to teach a little bit of history. He was trying to distinguish African Americans from Mexicans when, in fact, there is a good part of Africa in Mexico. And even some of our histories combined, as I was trying to point out in the article. I mean, we lost almost half the territory of Mexico when we refused to return back the slaves that had gone to Mexico. Nobody talks about the Underground Railroad going south. They talk about the one going north. You know? So it's just giving people the perspective of who we really are, that it's much more complicated, and we're really much more closer in interest than people think.
No, when I've shared that piece that you wrote about that was called "Why We Need a Deeper Dialogue on Black-Brown Relations," when I shared the piece that you wrote and then did some more studying myself after I read what you wrote, people's minds were blown by it. And this, most people here in Baltimore, in both the African American and white communities, but especially African American community, when I say to them, when I said in our conversations, well, look, you know, I'm reading this article and I start looking it up, and the first president of Mexico was a black man.
Right. In fact, there's been two presidents in Mexico that have African heritage. So that's way before most countries. And we even had a famous pure native person, Benito Juarez. So, I mean, there are certain things in Mexico. I'm not saying Mexico's behind a lot of things, but it is very advanced when it comes to some of those issues.
And I think that then, and there's a there is the blending and the power of that is in the first president of Mexico was the blending of the black and native people of Mexico who led the revolution to throw out the Spaniards in 1821.
Right. And I think that's important because one of the things that people don't know that the city of Los Angeles, for example, which is the second largest city, big, was founded by a mixture of African native, mostly African native peoples, and. We can say that it was actually founded by the people of color that is currently still in L.A. People think it was founded by just Spanish people, but the Spanish were actually only a handful, not even a handful. It was mainly African and Native mixtures of people.
You know, so as I was reading this, one of the things that struck me again is the power of understanding our history.
Right, that's important. I think what's really sad is I go to a lot of schools, I talk to a lot of kids, and I don't blame them. They really don't know history. They don't know the intricacies of it. They don't know the nuances. They get the version, you know, the official version, which kind of hides more than reveals.
Folks, you can join us. We're live tonight, 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow at gmail.com. Or get onto Facebook, The Mark Steiner Show, and drop your thoughts in there. I'll take a look at the Facebook page, see what you're thinking. Luis Rodriguez is with us. His first book, Always Running, La Vida Loca, Gang Days in L.A. His latest book is It Calls You Back, An Odyssey Through Love, Addiction, Revolutions, and Healing. And we're talking about the state of America, the state of Mexican and Latino relations with the African-American community. With where our country is going, we're going to get some of that as well. And with his own life working with gangs and going through gangs himself, 410-319-8888 to join us in this conversation. We're looking forward to having you be part of this show tonight. And those calls come in, we'll get to you as soon as they tell me who you are, 410-319-8888. Let me take a step back, Luis. I mean, because it's been some people on the East Coast here in Baltimore never heard of Luis Rodriguez.
Right, yeah.
Some have, but many have not.
I have a funny story about that. I was there many, many years ago. Remember when Fernando Valenzuela was getting famous?
Yeah.
Dodger pitcher.
Yeah.
People followed me around at a clothing store in Baltimore. They thought I was Fernando Valenzuela. It was so funny. They never seen a Mexican. And they looked at me, and I don't really look like him, but you can tell there's probably somebody there. You know, they found something. It was so funny.
It is, and now Baltimore has lots of Mexicans.
Yeah.
Lots.
Yeah. It's all over the country. They're all over the country, man. You know, you can't go anywhere without coming across Mexicans.
So, but let's go backwards for a minute. Then we'll go to Halim, our first caller up. So hold on, Halim. We're going to come to your call. It's just a little background about the book you wrote, Always Running, and where you've come to today. I mean, this is a book about your experience in the gang life in L.A. and in Chicago.
Yeah, and it's actually mostly in L.A. I spent 15 years in Chicago, did work with youth and gang youth. But what happened is my son joined a gang in Chicago. So I wrote this book 18 years ago now for him and for all those young people. And I just thought if I told my story, it might help somebody. And I didn't realize what a big impact it was going to have. I mean, I've been all over the place, and kids that read the book and kids who tell me they've changed their life because of the book. And, you know, it's not only one of the most read books, but in some cities, it's the most stolen book. You know, people they don't hear these kind of stories that often.
And the importance of the stories, I mean, are that this is it's how you grew up in that way, but also the power of the gangs and also the political and social power of organizing through gangs to stop the violence.
Right, both ends of it. And I think a lot of it comes from the same emptiness in our communities. And, of course, in African-American communities and poor white communities, as well as the Latino communities, wherever poverty is, you're going to have gangs. And they're going to take many different forms. But one of the things, though, is they're going to try to find a way to survive. And unfortunately, when there's no economy, you know, Baltimore got hit like this, too. The 80s industry. I know there was a big, huge Bethlehem Steel.
Yes.
And I worked in Bethlehem Steel in L.A. That's how I know about the Baltimore one. But, you know, all that stuff died. And unfortunately, the inner city got hit hard. And gangs, some of which have been existing forever, ended up becoming one of the ways that people could survive, which is rough. Most of it ended up being crime or drugs. But for some people, that was the only way they can get any income.
And as you apparently are writing in your latest book, this is your own battle from being a young man to being an older man and all the changes you went through as a working class kid from L.A., Chicago, and what sucked you back in and how you fought your way back out.
Yeah, I think it's important because, I mean, it turns out that kids... that Latino gang kids are numerous, and they have a long history. And people generally don't think about that. Now they do, but there used to be a time when they thought it was just an African-American issue. But it turns out that Latino gangs, some of them are oldest continuous street gangs in the country and extremely large. You know, in Chicago, as you know, you have the Latin Kings, and you got Latin Disciples. You got all kinds of the different associations here. And in L.A., you had a whole different culture there. That was what we call the Cholo culture. That includes, you know, all the Chicano gangs, but also, as you know, more recent gangs like the Salvadorian Mara Salvatrucha, these kind of gangs.
So I'm going to come back to ask you a question about that. But let me, as I promised, open the phones. We're talking with Luis Rodriguez for this hour. And let's go. The first caller up is Halim. Halim, you're on the air.
Yes. How y'all doing?
Very well. Welcome.
Good. Well, I think that relationships between the two groups are important, and I think one of the better ways to foster that relationship is to have African Americans and the Hispanic community working together. And, you know, my observation, I don't know how it happens, but it seems to me as I drive around the city, I'm a cab driver, and I drive all over the city, and it seems like it's, you know, just, I would say 95% to 100% Hispanic workers working on the city project. And it's only natural that some African Americans would be resentful of that, especially when the work is being done right in their own community. They can't get any work, but the Hispanics are getting the work. I think that there should be a concerted effort to ensure that on those contracts, African Americans get some of that work, and we work together on those projects, and then those relationships will naturally fall.
Now, I think you raised a really important issue, and a really important issue. And Luis,
I appreciate the caller. I agree with him. I mean, the sad thing about it is a lot of the guys from Mexico that are coming up are just being exploited. Now, I understand why they come up. I don't think we should attack them. I don't think they should be the scapegoat for everything. But there are a lot of Americans that could work, and they're not offered those positions. And so I think that, yeah, they should make sure that they get paid. But here's the problem. They're not going to get paid that cheap labor wage either. You know what I'm saying? People should expect that they have a livable wage, whether no matter where you come from. So I agree with them. I think we have to fight to make sure that the employers do the right thing, pay people a decent wage, get people from this country to, you know, be the ones they can get, and not use one group of people against the other.
And I think what Halim was saying, I mean, and also what we hear a lot in the streets here in Baltimore, what you hear a lot on this radio program, is that wedge. And the wedge is that there's this, Baltimore's, by official standards, 25% of the population is poor by official standards, which to me means that half the population is poor, because poor isn't at $22,000, it's maybe $32,000 in a family of four or even more.
Right.
So this is a city full of poor people. Unemployment rate in the African-American community is just out of sight. I mean, it's like 30% or more in the city, and even more in inner city neighborhoods. So what happens is when black folks see Latinos doing all the work, it begins to create this huge animosity, this anger towards one another.
Yeah, and I understand it, and I agree with the caller as well. It's an understandable situation when you don't got no work, and other people are coming in and they're taking the work. But again, I have to look at the employers, I have to look at these corporations. They're pitting one group against the other, and we end up turning against each other when really our interests are the same. Obviously, you're aware of that. We're basically in the same boat. When you're poor, you're poor, and instead of getting at each other, cutting each other's throats, I think he's got a good point. Let's work together to ensure that everybody can get a decent job.
And so the question I have for you before we go to our next caller, Baba, who's the next caller up, is how do we get – talk about how you think we get there, what you do to bridge that gap. I mean, because that is – there's a small group in town here in Baltimore called – now, not so small. They're really very active, called the United Workers. And they are Latino, African-American, and some white workers who are work at the very bottom of the scale in all the restaurants. And they've come together as an organization. They do a lot of creative work. They have a theater company. They're demonstrating for a living wage. They're educating workers, these worker intellectuals, to do this other stuff. They're really an interesting. They're on the show a great deal, but that's a small group of people. The question is how you begin to get that out, that this is really the same. You know what I'm saying?
I think you're right, and I think getting organized is the way to go. I mean, I think the reason why we keep being pitted against each other is we're disorganized, even when we are, you know, and even in the union job, we get disorganized. I think we have to organize as people who are deserving of a decent, livable wage work. And if we can't work like the old ways, and we have to think of new economies that can incorporate people, because that's where we're at now. You can't go back to those old jobs anymore. You have to think about what kind of new economies we're going to be able to create, which comes from community and comes from organization.
Let me reopen the phones at 410-319-8888. We're talking about Luis Rodriguez. His latest book is Calls You Back, An Odyssey Through Love, Addiction, Revolutions, and Healing. He came to the world scene in 1993 with his book Always Running, La Vida Loca, Gang Days in L.A., a memoir of his youth as a Latino gang member and working with his son. And he's written many books in between, and is also co-founder of Teatrucha Central Cultural in L.A., in East L.A. 410-319-8888 is the number here. And Baba, you're on the air.
Yes, hello.
Hi, Baba. Welcome.
Good evening, and good evening to your guest, Mr. Rodriguez. I had the opportunity of being in Mexico, in Acapulco, in the early 80s, and I met those Africans down there. In fact, some people had asked me, did you come down to see the divers? I said, no, I didn't come to Acapulco to look at the divers. Take me where the Africans are, which were on the other side of the island of where I was in Acapulco. And when I got off the plane, that's who I met first, was those Africans. And they took me over there. I also saw some of the remnants of places that they had built down there, the Aztecs had built down there, was almost similar to the pyramids. And I had a lovely time in Acapulco with the indigenous people, the people of the Aztec culture, and also the Africans. And I asked them, how did they get there? And they said they were brought in there as slaves by the European Spaniards. And when some of our, in my opinion, silly people want to talk about this type of division, do what the Mexicans do. Buy your own calves like the Africans do. And many of the businesses that these people, these Aztec people open up. Buy your own business and stop driving the Europeans' calves and stop complaining. Get your own business. And I had a wonderful time in your country and was treated very humanely by the Africans and the people of the Aztecs. Take care.
Take care, Baba. Good to hear from you.
That's great. I think people aren't aware of how deep the African roots go into Mexico. And, you know, that there's a claim somebody says that there may have been twice as many Africans brought in as slaves into Mexico than there were Spaniards. And I think also, I hate to say this, but the Mexican government doesn't really recognize that.
Mm-hmm.
It's starting to change, but they don't really recognize the African in Mexico. And that's really the indigenous is the majority of who we are. And then African is next, and then Spanish. So I think he's right. We have to put things right about what who we really are, how the countries were built, and how people interact and learn to live together as a people.
Let me get another phone call here before we go to break in a few minutes and come back with Luis Rodriguez, 410-319-8888. John in Harford County, you're on the air.
Oh, good evening.
Hi, John. Welcome.
I just want to point out that I think you're soft-pedaling around one aspect of this issue that you have to deal with, and that is that some of us see these workers out here, and I've seen them out in Harford County with Verizon laying the fiber optic cable, everyone 100% all Latino. And I can't help but wonder how many of these guys are illegal. Let's face it, a lot of them engage in criminal behavior just by coming into this country without the proper documentation and without going through the due process. And so that's a double whammy. Not only do they have these jobs, but they didn't even go through the proper channels to even get in the country in the first place. So that's going to create animus when you see people out there, you know, and they're making some of these, like Verizon, some of these people, they're paying them decent wage. It's not just, you know, below minimum wage jobs. Again, some of these are making a very good wage, still below what, you know, a union worker would get. But still, you know, when you're out of work, yeah, I don't care if you're used to making $25 an hour, if somebody offered you $15 and, you know, as opposed to not having a job, well, you'd rather have that. And why wouldn't you think that you would be do a little bit more consideration than somebody who's illegally in the country in the first place? And let's face it, they're sending most of their money back to Mexico or wherever, whatever country they originate from in South America, and, you know, bringing even subsidizing even more illegals coming over here. I'd like to hear what your guests have to say about that.
Okay.
You can't get away from that issue.
John, thank you so much. Luis?
Well, I think we can try to explain it. People don't realize that to go by legal means in Mexico to get your status in the United States takes an average of 16 years. People don't realize it is very difficult. It's if you're from England, an average of less than a year. There are people who that have a better chance of getting their papers than others. People of color, people from Haiti all the way through all the Americas just have a harder time. Now, again, I was born here, so I am a U.S. citizen. I love Mexico, and I go back and forth. I have family there, but I am a U.S. citizen. And but I know what happens. And now here's the other thing. Mexico happens to have 60% employment, unemployment or underemployment. It's a great country. It's a great country. It cannot sustain itself. So I think we have to look at these things. Instead of trying to look at whether somebody's here legally or not, it's more like what are we doing as a world, as a continent, as a hemisphere, and as a country to make sure that people's needs are met. To me, that's the most important thing. We are being pitted against each other because they're suffering in the inner city just like they're suffering in these countries, and people are making sure that people come here that, can be worked at some kind of way, cheaper wage level, non-union, you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
But I think we just got to look at that. I mean, it's just very hard. If people can get here within a year's time to become legal citizens, they wouldn't be coming across the border. They risk a tremendous amount of life and limb just to come across that border. Nobody really wants to do that. I got people in Mexico that say they love their country, but they can't work. So we have a big picture. It's a global picture. It's more than what people think. You know, in Europe, it's a lot of Africans and Arab communities that come up. They have the same issue. They can't work in their countries, and they end up going to Europe. And people wouldn't see them the same way. They would see them as poor people trying to survive. I think that you got the same thing in America.
We're talking with Luis Rodriguez for this hour, and we originally were going to speak about the Afro-Latino world and the article he wrote recently about that, and we just expanded the discussion just to talk about where America is, some of the things he's been writing. Very soon we'll hope to have Luis back as well to talk about his new book, It Calls You Back, An Odyssey Through Love, Addiction, Revolutions, and Healing. Right now we're going to take a very brief break and come right back with Luis. And when we come back, let me see, look at the phone list here. James in Baltimore and Marie, you are the next two callers up, and we'll come to your calls as well. And we have a comment from Facebook. We'll read that when we come back, so stay with us and don't go away. We'll be right back. I'm Mark Steiner. We'll be here with Luis Rodriguez.
Support for WEAA is provided by APG Federal Credit Union, serving the community and members who live, work, worship, volunteer, or go to school in Harford and Cecil counties. APG Federal Credit Union, your community credit union. Member benefit information available online at apgfcu.com. And members like you. Thank you.
The following is a public service announcement from WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community.
Saturday, October 8th, the Just For Us Foundation will sponsor its first Awareness Walkathon event at Laurel High School at 9 a.m. As part of the Disability Awareness Month, this event will raise money for its programs for children with special needs and promote healthy lifestyles. For more information, email walk at justforusfoundation.org.
What does it take to make democracy work? We'll talk with someone who interprets the U.S. Constitution for a living, literally. Justice Stephen Breyer joins us on Democracy and Brinkmanship, A Judge's View, and all the news from around the nation and the world next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
The Takeaway, weekdays at 6 a.m., only on Public Radio WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community.
Hi, I'm John Tegler, and I have the pleasure of being the host of Jazz Straight Ahead here on WEAA, a series that features the fun and excitement of America's only indigenous art form, that music called jazz. Whether it's combos, vocalists, or big bands, you'll hear it all right here on Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community.
Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. Before we jump back into our conversation with Luis Rodriguez, I want to remind you that a tradition continues with the second annual WEAA Gospel Grace Benefit Concert featuring the legendary Lady Tremaine Hawkins. Also performing will be the Morgan State University Choir, Sunday, October 30th, 6 p.m. at the Murphy Fine Arts Center. Ticket information at Ticketmaster.com, Ticketmaster Outlets, or 410-547-SEAT. That's S-E-A-T. Presented by the Morgan MBA program and Public Radio WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And I'm Mark Steiner here on WEAA as we talk with Luis Rodriguez. He is a former gang member. He is an artist. He is a writer and a poet, a political activist organizing across L.A. and around this country, working with gangs for many, many years. We first met him in 1993 with his book, Always Running La Vida Loca, Gang Days in L.A., and he has a new book out, which he'll come back to this program for once we get the book and read it and bring him back. It Calls You Back, and obviously this will love addiction, revolutions, and healing. And the number here is 410-319-8888, or write to us here, steinershow@gmail.com. And Luis, let me read this piece that someone wrote in on Facebook page. Ramiro Arceo wrote in, "Great. Too bad I'm in D.C. for training and will miss the live show. I love Luis Rodriguez. Had the pleasure of meeting him before and ran workshops with him in North Carolina. I will listen to the podcast." Okay, well, you can listen to the podcast. 410-319-8888. Before I come back to my questions and thoughts for Luis, let's go to the phones, as I promised. And James in Baltimore, you're on the air.
How you doing?
Well, James, welcome.
I love your show.
Thank you.
Thing about these games, if you can just get to the real root of what all started, because they were, most of these games were really organizations. You know, like the Latin Kings was an organization before it turned into what is this big time street game. The Guerrilla Family, well, even some of them white gangs were just regular old organizations before they branched off into these, you know, hard crime street gangs. But if you get really down into it, you know, into, even into this, you know, people needing jobs and things like that, referral, a lot of these Mexicans that come over here, they don't, a lot of them that's, you know, illegals ain't here to really break law. A lot of them come over here just to find jobs. They really need jobs, you know. And they just want to have a better life. And, you know, and as it goes down to, you know, they get referral from a friend who knows a friend from a brother that stole something. You know, it's just that the fact that a lot of the brothers just don't want to work for that, you know, that low-wage salary. They just ain't really trying to put up with it. And some of the Mexicans, you know, it's a difference between somebody that wants something, that needs something. They need it. You know, they got family to feed. But like I was saying at first, I mean, we get into the real history of what these street gangs were about, man. They were just organizations before they, you know, even turned to them.
Thank you, James. I think you make an important point. Let's go back to that. Luis, I mean, in terms of what he was talking about, especially what he was talking about with the gangs.
Yeah, you know, when I remember growing up in the gangs, I mean, they're not what they are today, you know. They were protection groups. They were groups of guys that didn't have much family, so they created their own families. They were there for each other, you know, but things get complicated and more sophisticated. And then in the 80s, everybody went through this. We had three major things happen. One, jobs were leaving the inner city. So that affected black and brown communities. Two, drugs came in. I mean, drugs was always part of gangs, but not really like it is now. It's central to gangs, whereas before it used to be periphery. And then the other thing that happened in the 80s was the big rise in gun. You know, we had guns 40-some years ago, but most guys didn't really use guns. It was more about fighting, you know what I mean?
Right, right, I do.
Now it's like anybody got a gun. Nobody has to even know how to fight. They're all killers, you know. It's changed so much, and I think it's related. The industry leaving, the jobs leaving, more people unemployed, drugs coming in, people utilizing that to help keep their economy going, and then the guns. So now you're seeing gangs are armed, you know, extremely dangerous, and this is both in the black and brown community and, of course, in some of the poor white communities. So I think we're seeing a major problem that affects everybody.
So tell me, in this last 18 years since you wrote La Vida Loca and what you're describing, what you see now, 18 years later, almost 19 years later, how do you intervene in that? I mean, what do you do to intervene in that? Tell me, talk a bit about what you do and what and how you think it has to happen and what we should be doing.
Yeah, I do a number of things. One is we, of course, work with prevention. That means trying to get as many kids from wanting to join a gang in the first place. That's as much as you can do. And then when you do have kids join gangs, we do a lot of intervention. Intervention means you come in the resources, guidance, mentors. You go in there with jobs. You go in there with educational possibilities. You do what we call wraparound services, and I try to get other cities to provide it because I know this is hard economic times and people saying there's no money, but in the long run, you lose out when you don't really invest in young people. I think most of these kids wouldn't be in a gang and wouldn't be selling drugs if they knew that there was a real option out there for them to live as decently as possible and to survive. I think that's what we have to help create, new economies, new ways of interacting, new relationships. We need real mentorships. We need real support from community to help save these kids. I know it's difficult, but I get tired of losing kids that don't need to be lost.
Yep, I know. It breaks my heart every time another kid goes away.
Yeah.
Either prison or to death or to whatever it is that we lose.
Especially, I'm convinced it's not necessary. Most of these kids, vast majority, can be saved, will be saved, but we're kind of like not paying attention to that.
So, before we go to Maria, our next caller up, I want you to just describe, if you would, what you co-founded in East L.A., what Tia Chucha is, what you've done there.
What this is an arts-based group. I believe in the arts. The arts saved me. I use the arts in all ages, but especially with the troubled youth. The arts is about the music. We teach music, all instruments. We teach them dance, we teach them theater, writing, painting. We have an art gallery. I had this one girl who was a drug-using, loose-sniffing girl. She was 14 years old. Two years later, she's 16. We just had her art show, her photography, beautiful photography. I really I believe that the art is one of the key ways to bring youth engaged, get them engaged, and get them active, and get them to feel that they have some skills that they can develop into something that could possibly end up being their survival.
Now, I have some more questions about that because I'm very interested about your notion of the arts, and it also is kind of the tipping point of the new world, kind of a revolutionary look at America and where we could go. But let me open the phones first at 410-319-8888 as we continue our conversation with Luis Rodriguez from L.A. And Marie in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Hi, good evening, gentlemen. Thank you for having me on your show. I have a few comments. Basically, they're very quick. I agree mostly with everything you said as far as the gangs. Things changed in the 80s. I can remember growing up, and even though they were gang members, they were like, go to school and do the best you can. So things have changed, values and all of that. But my main concern, I came in on the end of your comment, and I wanted to know what did you feel about, do you think because of it being 16 years to become a legal citizen, do you think that is a prerequisite for everyone to come here illegal because they don't want to do that 16-year time or whatever time frame it takes to become legal? And that was it. You guys have a great night, and I'll listen to your response.
Thank you so much, Maria Luis.
Well, I think like anybody, people aren't going to stay starving too long. I hate to say that, but it's just that they're not. We happen to be a very rich country. Just like I said, a lot of people from Africa and the Middle East are coming to Europe because it's relatively more well-off. Relative, because we know there's poverty, but in other words, people are going where they think they can get work, where they think they can survive. It doesn't mean it's going to happen. I mean, people have the idea that the streets are paved with gold in the U.S. Well, that's not true. You're going to have to work hard. You may not make it. But what it is people are going there for the same reasons that any one of us would want to survive. I personally believe Mexico should take care of its own people, should have a better economy. But right now, Mexico, as you know, is a terribly violent place right now with the drug cartels. The government's extremely corrupt. They're not really doing what needs to be done to provide people decent jobs. The corporations there are very corrupt. It's the world that we're in. Instead of downing these people coming over, I think we have to fight for a better economy and better world for us in this country, but also be a model for others. I mean, we need to have sustainable global economies. Otherwise, people will keep coming.
So, Luis, a couple of things about that I want to pick up. And, folks, the lines are open again out, 410-319-8888. So feel free to join us with Luis Rodriguez, activist, artist, writer, one of the most read writers around our country. His bestseller book, Always Running, La Vida Loca, Gang Days in L.A., is still being read around the country. His latest book is It Calls You Back, An Odyssey Through Love, Addiction, Revolution, and Healing. 410-319-8888. You can write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. One of the things I was reading, something that you wrote, and it is, you see in some ways the power of what could change America to change this kind of the madness of poverty that's growing in America, and when the dislocation of working people and poor people and middle class people and how everything is happening in this country. You see some of it coming from young folks and from the artistic core. Talk a bit about that.
Well, you know, I think that the old ways of doing things ain't going to work, and we keep falling back into them. The government, I think, Congress and administration are not able to imagine new ways. I think we have to go back to the community, go back to youth. I talk to so many of them, and, you know, they have amazing answers. You know, nobody's ever going to give them any money or support, but if you were to just get some of these young people and put them in Congress and put some of this resources in their hands, I think they will resolve a lot of these things. It's not going to be easy, but you know what I'm saying?
Uh-huh.
They have an imagination that we've kind of lost, and we need to tap into that. And being creative and artistic helps you do that on a regular basis. When things get rough, like I said, you know, the way out of chaos isn't really, the first step isn't ordered like people think it is. It's creativity. When you're in a chaotic state, you have to be creative. How do I get out? What do I have to do? And then once you find an equilibrium with the creativity and imagination, you can have some real order. But people are forgetting that big stage that you have to be imaginative now. And I think young people have a lot of that imagination.
And in your own life, as my guess is when I'm looking forward to reading this next book of yours, that even if you have the creative urge, even if you have the political consciousness that says, I think we need to change America and I will devote my life to it, and of stopping the gang violence and doing all the rest, there's something about the struggle of getting through it that creates its opposite.
I think, if I'm getting what you're saying, I think it's just important for us to care again, even if we don't get all the answers in our hands, to say, I love this country, I love my people, I love our community, I love humanity. I'm going to fight for a better world. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
That changes people. It changes youth. I've changed a lot of young people from being criminally minded into gangs and violence to being active again because somehow they got convinced, hey, I can make a better world. At least strive for it. That's what helped me. I was a very violent young man. I got mentored by activists in the Chicano movement. I read Malcolm X and all the writers, James Baldwin and all the writers of those days that African Americans that influenced me. I saw there was possibilities in having the idea of a possibility in someone's life, especially a young person who feels limited by everything, is empowering and revolutionary. I like to extend that. When I work with youth, I don't just say, hey, stop committing crimes, start killing people, stop doing all this stuff, and then walk away. I have to help them have a vision. What's possible and where they contribute to make it possible.
We're talking with Luis Rodriguez, 410-319-8888. Rachel's here at steinershow@gmail.com. Think about our communities here in Baltimore and D.C., the listening area that we have, all around the state of Maryland into Pennsylvania. What your thoughts are about that and how we have to intervene in these lives and what we can do to make these changes. 410-319-8888. Luis, we do this. We're doing this series of conversations on the program. And I guess for want of a better title, I'm calling them is capitalism the problem, or is there another way, or is there another way?
Yeah.
So if I was to ask you that question, what would you say?
Well, here's the problem. I think capitalism is one of these sacred cows. Nobody wants to touch it because we think it's a God-given thing. It's a man-made system. It served a great purpose. There was a time, even Karl Marx would tell you this, where capitalism was the most revolutionary thing going. What I'm saying? But everything has to have a beginning and an end. We're at a period of time, especially with industry, completely changing to electronic digital technology. It's a big shift in the whole world. It's a global shift. It's like it was as momentous as when we went from agriculture, farming societies to industrial societies. Now we're from going to industrial to this electronic digital, and I see great potential in the technology, but also in our relationships and also our relationship to the earth for a clean, healthy development of human beings as well as our world around us. That's what I'm looking at. I'm thinking we need some new imaginations, new economies. Go beyond capitalism. I'm not saying that everything in capitalism is rotten. Just take what's good in it. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
But I think mostly it's about going to whole new ways of cooperating, of exchange. I mean, money is becoming obsolete. Everybody knows that, but we're stuck with it. Why? These are man-made things that now no longer work. Just think of other ways that we can have relationships of exchange, and how do we get commerce moving again without it being tied to competition and profit? You know what I'm getting at?
Yeah. And I think that in this last crisis, we had the financial crisis, the meltdown, where Wall Street was bailed out, that discussion began to arise about we don't really need money. What money is just a fabrication.
It's a fabrication, and then we're putting up these banks. Banks are becoming obsolete, but we're still putting them up. It's like, why don't we reimagine everything, reconsider? Let's get what we really need. What's essential? I think a healthy, well-rounded life for as many people as possible is the way to go. And let's find the economy and the politics to align our resources and our people so that can happen for everyone.
And it's almost though that people, in many ways, and listeners, I really want to hear your thoughts on this, that people begin to feel isolated in many ways. There's these demonstrations we'll hear about the next hour that are going on Wall Street that nobody's covering in the media.
Right.
There were activists from all over Canada, in the United States, getting arrested in front of the White House to say no to the tar sands in Canada. They have these things going on all over the place, and the people all over the country, I literally mean by the millions, are standing up in small pockets and saying, look, this we want our life back. This is ridiculous.
Right.
But people feel disconnected, and nobody even knows what the other person's doing.
Yeah, like, for example, that Wall Street protest, which I feel really bad for these young people. They're getting hurt. They're getting, you know, maced. But here's the thing. You're not going to have a lot of people supporting them until you've done that preparation. Coming to communities of color, poor communities. You know what I'm saying. Making this not just an act of a few people who are very angry and upset for good reason, but making it an act of real organization and expansion and unity. We needed people to come to all these communities and say, okay, we're going to do this protest at Wall Street. How does it make sense to you? You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I don't want people hurt, but I am saying that the tactics now have to be, how do we bring in as many people as possible, education, preparation, artistic ways, creative ways, imaginative ways, have vision, not just I'm protesting what's bad, but fight for something that's really different and new and decent for everybody.
And so I'm thinking about what you just wrote for the Huffington Post and how you take this Latino Heritage Month, and as you did with the Cat Williams piece, rather than lashing out and calling names, is using it as a moment, using this moment as a time to talk about the possibilities, and talk about the past. Now the past is tied to the future and the
people
present.
People call them teaching moments. Maybe that's a cliche, but I think there's some truth to it. Instead of using this thing to just bash everybody and jump on everybody, and let's think about what are we learning from it as a whole. I mean, to me, every action should be a teaching thing, and every teaching thing should lead to some better action. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we need to combine the both. We all need to learn. We need to learn, for example, about our class interests. We need to learn about strategies. We need to know who are really our enemies are. Sometimes we're fighting each other more than people who are really out to hurt us. We just need to learn these things, and that comes from teaching. But also, let's have some real action that can get people better organized, achieve real things, you know what I mean, real solutions, learn from them, evaluate them, and get back at it again.
Now, Luis, I don't want to put you on the spot, brother, but I'm going to ask you a question, and maybe I shouldn't do this without writing you an email first, because you might have it in front of you. But I'm going to give the people a flavor of your creativity. Do you have, like, close by you or in your head, a one of your poems or something that you can share with our listeners now, just to give a sense of the kind of stuff that you share with the world?
Well, I tell you what, I read from the new book, a short little passage. Does that sound good?
That's great, man. I want to read this book. I can't wait to get it.
Yeah, and it's short, and maybe I'll just read from the very beginning, because if anybody's ever been to jail or prison know what this is like, and it starts off by saying, "You'll be back." These were the last words I heard as I walked away from the clanging locks and gates, the incessant yells and howls of the downtown Los Angeles County Jail. A sheriff's deputy taunted me with these words after I bailed out from being held on resisting arrest and assaulting police officers. If convicted, I'd do a minimum of 6 years in the state penitentiary. The year was 1973. Charges stem from the police beating of a handcuffed young Mexican woman lying on her stomach on the parking lot of an after-hours club. Several deputies were striking and kicking her as she screamed for help. A few drunkards around sauntered away. I was high on heroin, alcohol, pills. I used to like combining these damn things. I turned to walk away as well, but something in me wouldn't let me. At 18 years of age, I felt tired, lost, after being forced to move away from my neighborhood and in a garage where I had lived in a small room and with a bucket and bunk where I got high with three girls I called squeezes. I did something no true gangster would do. I tried to stop the beating. That's the beginning of the book.
Like, oh, man.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so as soon as we get a copy of the book, I'm going to read it, and then we're going to come back on and have you on to talk about the book.
Thank you so much.
We're going to do that. But we do have an email from Ramiro, who writes in, hello, Mark. I made it back, and I'm really enjoying our conversation with Luis. Oh, this is Ramiro Arceo, who wrote it on Facebook. I'd like to comment on a thing I caught when I was rushing home that Luis said about the connections between African-Americans and Latino community. When I was a teacher here in Baltimore City, all my students were African-American. I'm a Mexican, and I always tried to explain to them our connections and similarities in our cultures and how it is a certain segment of the population who historically has tried to pit us against each other. Can you please ask Luis, if time permits, to comment on the workshops he did he did while he did a residency in North Carolina back in the year 2000 with high schools there. Mr. Alonzo, Baltimore City School CEO, should look into bringing Luis to do the same thing here. It would create a huge impression and begin a link of understanding between our youth.
Yeah, what he's talking about is that I was given the largest writer's residency in the state of North Carolina's history. It was a 10-week, 21 events a week that I did from one end of the state to the other. I never knew much about North Carolina. I learned to love its people and its land. It's a very beautiful, diverse place, state, but also the Latino population, I think, had risen like 600%. There were so many tensions, and I spoke everywhere. I went to prisons. I went to juvenile lockups. I went to schools. I went to conferences. I went to churches. I went to migrant camps, and I was all over the place. It was an amazing thing, and we did work with young people to learn to interact with each other, learn to care about each other, learn to realize that it's the old Mayan saying. It's called In Lakish. It says, you are the other me, that we're all related. We're all connected. If we work to help each other, we will help ourselves. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
If I make your life easier and decent and worthwhile, my life will be easier, decent, and worthwhile. So it was a really beautiful thing that I did in North Carolina. I'm glad he brought it up. We've never been able to replicate it, but it would be great if we could do it in other places.
Hmm. I like what you said also, the Mayan saying, you are the other me.
Yeah, in that case, it means you are the other me. Isn't that beautiful?
That's amazing. It is beautiful. I've never heard that before you said it. But
I want to share. I think that's what that should be a concept for everybody, that we should at least begin at that stage, that where we are, you are than me, let's take care of each other, because then I'll be taken care of.
You know, what that says is, to me also, is like it's that it says it's the golden rule that the Bible taught, the Bible that most Americans use talk about, it's the same thing.
It absolutely is. I mean, it's that principle, perennial, absolute truth, that if you treat others the way you want to be treated, that's the way you should go, because then others should treat you that way. If you treat people with respect, you treat people as decent human beings, you should be expected to be treated the same way. That, to me, is the best way to go.
And so in all you've been through and all you've seen in I think it's important just to kind of add just a minute before we go is how you keep your vision, your being the way you perceive what we're facing and what the world is in now, in what feels like coming through the microphone is a very positive light.
I think I have to, my son did a total of 15 years in prison.
Yeah.
Every day he was in prison, I couldn't sleep right. I was worried about him, but I thought, what should I do? Should I be negative? Should I be angry? Should I let him go? No, I had to be closer to him. I had to be positive for him. I had to let him know that I could change. I'm 18 years sober, which is part of the story of my book. I had to teach him that if I can change, if I went from a gang to heroin addict to alcoholic and I changed my life, you can. And you know what? He has done that. He got released last year, and now he's helping turn kids around. Now he's helping with gang kids. He's working with a group called Build here in Chicago, and they work with the most troubled kids and try to help them. So that's my example. I might as well be positive because I know it's to so many others.
Luis Rodriguez, it's just been a pleasure to talk to you once again. I'm glad we had this whole hour together, and I look forward to reading It Calls You Back, An Odyssey Through Love, Addiction, and Revolution and Healing. We'll read that book, get you back in the air, and have a good discussion on the next phase of your existence from that book.
Thank you, sir. Let's do it again.
Take care, brother.
All right, bye.
We've been talking to Luis Rodriguez, and we'll have his information on our website. You can go up to his website, which we will link to on our website. But if you're interested now, it's www.luisjrodriguez.com. But that'll all be on our website. You can see the work that he's been doing, and he'll be on this show more, as much as we can get him back on with others to have these discussions. As we get ready to shift gears here, I want to remind you the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the University of Maryland, Marlene and Stuart Greenbaum Cancer Center, an NCI-designated cancer center providing research, treatment, and education to further the prevention of and cure of cancer. Online at www.umgcc.org. Well, the number for information is 1-800-888-23. We're going to take a very brief break in a minute here and come right back. When we do come back, we'll be talking about with a young man who has been on Wall Street demonstrating with Dr. Margaret Flowers, who is planning a demonstration for October 2011. And then the last part of our show, Dr. Margaret Flowers is with us as we debate the future of America and Wall Street with Charles Lohler. So all that coming up in the next hour. So don't go away. I'll be right back.